if you are going to make one of these offers, if you do not have at least three boxes of Space Raiders on the table, then we're not interested, okay? Everyone, welcome to Bad Voltage, show 28 of season 2, released on the... I've forgotten what you said, language.
The 22nd of March, 2018, should be when you listen to this.
Like better those Bad Voltage intros.
You said a lot of numbers, and I forgot the numbers, What are we going to talk about in the show today?
Well, our big piece is going to be about Mycroft. The Mycroft team are bringing out the Mark II, and we're going to talk about how it might work out.
And we're also going to talk about quite a bit of different news items, and this is definitely a segment that is getting beefier and beefier as time goes on. So I'd like to know, from the community perspective, how they like the news. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I agree. It would be good to know.
I personally really like doing the news.
Yeah, same here. Yeah, it's like going to a sweet shop with loads of, you know, news in it.
It is absolutely nothing like that. Despite that horrible, horrible analogy.
So, and now, sweet shop voltage.
I'm going to leave it at that one.
Shall we?
Do the news.
Shall we do some news?
Do the news. Speak the news.
It's always time. What do you want to start with? I mean, we have a bit of news in here. Jeremy's news is absently missing, by the way. Slacker.
What are you talking about? I put two things in there.
You did? What did you put in there?
I put Uber self-driving, and I see Stuart removed it and then added it under his own name, which was a little sneaky.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
Now I have to say,
can't trust it.
When I looked at our show notes, it looked like exactly like last time's. So I just deleted it all and put stuff in.
But I see under news, under Jeremy, I added my news stories.
Oh, sorry.
since we have already brought this one up and it was on two of our lists, why don't we jump right in with the Uber self-driving car killed a pedestrian?
Yes.
All right, go on then.
So, this is not the first case that someone has died as a result of an autonomous vehicle, but we have spoken at length about kind of both the technical side of this and the human side of this. And basically what happened here was an Uber self-driving car that had a driver in the driver's seat, which is still mandatory, at least in the U.S., hit a pedestrian. What had happened previously is someone was using a Tesla in a way that you weren't supposed to use the autonomous driving. It didn't detect, a sensor failed on detecting a semi that was white, and the car went underneath the semi, and the driver of the vehicle died. In this case, the Uber hit someone that was outside of a crosswalk, right. And from what I've seen, and it seems to be a story that's updating like right as we are recording this, but the preliminary indication is that if the autonomous vehicle was a person, they would not be charged.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
that's interesting.
It does seem to be updating a lot.
That changed by the time this actually is being listened to. So
yes, this is a very, very breaking news story indeed.
Yes. It is, and we are not the best people to report it. Let's be honest.
I have seen it suggested that the car was doing 40 miles an hour in possibly a 35 mile an hour limit, but again, that may be one report, and it may not be the truth at all. So don't necessarily base anything on that. It all seems quite unclear what's gone on. Obviously, the discussion has now become either this is what we warned you about from day one, or some palatable way of saying, well, you know, this kind of thing happens. We're sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say about this, because look, this is, it's awful, of course, but like, I mean,
anyone dying is a tragedy, right?
Yes,
of course it is. Yeah, but I think it's just one of those things where, look, if you're going to be building technology that's going to have if you're building technology that moves in the physical world, then there is a risk that someone's going to get hurt in a physical way, in the same way that if you're connecting computers to the internet, then there's a risk that someone's going to get hacked. So
I think here's the thing from my perspective on this. Last year, there were well over a million deaths in road crashes across the world, well over 30,000 just in the U.S. So this isn't like we have autonomous cars and now all of a sudden people are dying. I'm fairly confident that even when the technology's new, they will kill less people than people driving.
Yes,
that is certainly the hope. Yes,
certainly based in California, where people drive like crazy people.
Yes,
right, and as someone who lives in snow, like every time someone in like a pickup truck that's rear-wheel drive with no weights in it flies by me in the snow going 90, I would like to presume an autonomous vehicle is not going to do that.
One would hope not. So there is a question about whether this is being rushed into. I think most people, unless you're massively against the whole idea of autonomous cars,
people are, to be clear.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I think most people would say the optimal rate of deaths is zero, obviously. Sure. But if we reduce the number of deaths from driving, that's on balance a good thing. That doesn't make each individual death unfortunate. There is a question about whether we're testing it too fast, too far. You know, whether we could reduce even these few deaths that have happened by being more careful about it, rather than a desperate rush to be the first people to put one on the market.
The tricky thing there, I think, is no matter. I mean, first of all, we don't know. That's a question that's almost impossible to answer.
Yes.
Right? Is we don't know how. It's impossible to know whether we're going at the right pace. And I'm confident that any company that is investing in this technology is going to great levels of care to make sure that this kind of thing isn't going to happen. But there are tragedies, right? And you know. It's a shame, but I think technology marches forward, and eventually they'll figure it out. But I agree with Jeremy. I think in the long view, this kind of technology will have a better, broader impact for humanity than letting Muppets drive cars, you know, of which I consider myself to be one of those Muppets, by the way. I'm not suggesting I'm a great driver, so I'm not.
I mean, we've covered this before. It's very difficult. It's difficult to even think about, but there has to be some amount of programming in there, knowing that it's going to kill someone, what decision it will make to do that and not try to kill more people, for example, and stuff like that. So it's definitely an area of questionable morality, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, this doesn't seem to have been some kind of reenactment of the trolley problem, no. Right? This is a car which hit a pedestrian. It shouldn't have hit.
Yeah.
It's not like it avoided 9 other pedestrians in order to hit this person. But yeah, so...
What I'm curious to...
This is kind of one of the... I think, are we all agreed this is one of those things where you go, this is bad, but we kind of knew it was going to happen, so it's not unanticipated.
Yeah, it's a shame. But it's you know, it's to be expected, right? In the same way that I'm sure that, you know, there are many people who suffer terrible health problems while testing out revolutionary drugs for battling cancer and AIDS and whatever else, you know, because people are, you know, it's part of evolution of technology, right? But it is really sad. The one thing I'm curious about is, you know, I would have imagined that for companies, when they produce a technology that results in someone's death, that particularly in the US, they would be sued to hell and back. And I'm curious to see how a company can stay afloat building a technology that will, by definition, probably involve the death of people. In, you know, it's the same thing with, like I say, with drugs and other things. I'm curious to see how that's handled, because, I mean, I think in the pharmaceuticals world, then there's probably just an ass load of insurance to deal with that. I'm assuming that's the situation with this as well, so... I don't know.
I don't actually know. Next news item.
Yeah, let's move on. I have one. So we did a segment a while back about fake news, and we had a really interesting discussion about it. I had this idea of just a harebrained idea that maybe people could kind of collaborate together in some way to moderate fake news in some capacity. And I thought it was interesting. I read earlier today about Google are launching a pretty big news initiative to somewhat try and combat false news, but also help publishers to make money. So this is interesting because it's broken into two areas. One area is, it seems like, from what I scanned over this, and I didn't spend a lot of time digging into this because I saw it just before the show. It seems like Google are trying to replicate something like the Netflix model, where you can basically subscribe to services and get content. So news isn't as driven by advertising. And the argument here is that, you know, if you put advertising on a news website, then you get more BuzzFeed-y type clickbait because people want to, you know, make money on the advertising. So that's one element. So they're launching this thing called Subscribe with Google, which is essentially a monetization model for news outlets. But the other thing I thought was interesting is that they are creating the Disinfo Lab with Harvard's Kennedy School, and that's aimed at clarifying misinformation during elections and breaking news moments. It will also launch MediaWise, an organization in conjunction with the Poynter Institute, Stanford University, and the local media association, which will work to develop digital literacy for young viewers. Apparently, they're pushing in. I read somewhere that they're putting in something like $300 million over the course of the next X number of years into this broader news initiative. So, I just thought it was, Google said it's committing $300 million over the next 3 years to the project, though it's not going to elaborate on how the resources will be spent. The company said it paid $12.6 billion to news organizations that drove 10 billion clicks a month to their websites for free last year. So
I think it's interesting, too, they're taking kind of a three-pronged approach, right? They're making it ostensibly easier to pay for news, and I'm curious how that will go. That's a difficult problem that a lot of organizations have been trying to tackle for a while now. But then they're also, like you said, working with some established universities and some established nonpartisan groups to combat that misinformation. And then they're also setting up an open source tool called Outline, which allows journalists to access things securely and a bunch of stuff around that. So the fact that they're clearly put some thought into this, it's not just like, hey, we're going to fight misinformation. They have a clear approach with at least a three-year plan with some pretty significant resources behind it. This is a critical problem for them to solve, given how they monetize and how they're basically funded. I mean, I know they have a lot of businesses, but the ad business is still by far their largest revenue generator. So getting this figured out is going to be critical for the kind of short to mid-term success of that advertising platform. I think this is an issue that's reaching a breaking point for sure.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm kind of skeptical about a lot of this. I mean, the subscribe with Google thing seems to apparently be a way that you can subscribe to a particular news organization and then pay for your news and then get it. Now, almost every news organization already has that. Right, and I don't see what Subscribe with Google is going to bring to make that easier, other than the fact that Google get 5% when everyone does it. But maybe there's more complexity to it than I think there is. Outline, which is the news organisations getting secure access to the internet and so on, seems a lot like SecureDrop to me, which already exists and is open source. But I do think the Disinfo Lab is interesting. This is
that's the most interesting bit to me as well.
To clarify misinformation. They're quoted as saying it will use computational tools and journalistic oversight to monitor misinformation during elections. And it's going to be interesting to see what they come up with there, because I don't know. Even if they manage to identify loads of misinformation, people aren't going to necessarily be reading the stuff the Disinfo Lab put out saying this is misinformation. Right, that was the problem. I'm not really sure how that's going to work out. We already have fact checkers.
People surface information through search engines, so if the search engines collectively say if it's below some misinformation score.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
If you look at that,
I think is interesting. I mean, yes, there is an actual problem of identifying which things are fake and which things are not. But the more important point is getting that word out to the people who are currently sharing it and reading it and so on. So that's going to be really interesting to see how they solve that problem.
Well, I was going to say that setting a dangerous precedent once you start classifying what is misinformation. Because misinformation to whom and by what bar and by what standard. And there's a whole lot of gray area in there that getting this wrong is going to probably ruin the internet forever.
Yeah. Who makes the decision and how do you set it up so they can't decide the bad news about them is lies, you know?
It's going to be interesting because, I mean, if you look at Google Analytics for most websites, for example, most of the traffic that tends to come to websites is the majority of it is coming from search engines and social media these days.
Yeah.
Very rarely coming through like direct access or other means. So if obviously Google, most popular search engine in the world, if they can help to rectify this issue, I think it will have a tremendous impact. And likewise, if the social media, the Twitter and Facebook, despite the Facebook news, which we'll get onto, seem to be recognizing that they do have a role to play in this issue around fake news and disinformation. So I'd like to think also that this will somewhat apply some pressure to these other organizations that they need to do something as well. I'm, like you, curious to see exactly how this works. And I'm also curious to see what inbuilt protections are made, because what's going to almost certainly happen here is a lot of people are going to look at the whole incident that happened with James Damore and the diversity memo. And a lot of people will throw shade towards Google that they themselves are biased in one direction. I'm curious to see how they're going to build into this any potential accusations that Google themselves will be building bias into the actual program itself. because any organization would have to do that. Like if Fox News were going to run something like this, they'd have to have sufficient provisions to protect the program from themselves.
To demonstrate that it was, in fact, fair and balanced, yes.
Yeah. fair and balanced.
One of the interesting things there is that Google, on the one hand, are providers of a search engine by which you find content and you see what gets surfaced and what doesn't. But with YouTube, they're also a collector of that content and direct people to various other things on. And you'd think they'd have more control over what YouTube does than what Twitter and Facebook do. So one early indicator of whether this program is successful or not is whether YouTube gets dramatically better all of a sudden.
I mean, there has been huge controversy about Google's operation of YouTube in recent months.
Oh, absolutely. We talked about it a few shows ago, and it's kind of constantly going on about how much YouTube is a part of this problem. You know, it's not just Twitter and Facebook.
There is no doubt. I mean, without turning this political, I mean, as I've said many times in the show, I don't align myself with either side. I'm pretty much down the middle, but there is no doubt that YouTube has got a more of a left-leaning bias due to the consistent kind of demonetization of not hate stuff, but like a lot of conservative commentators, for example, have had their YouTube videos consistently demonetized. So I'm curious to see again.
I like your definition of not to turn this political while making the most political statement possible.
Yeah,
to
that was a fail there.
I think sharing my opinion is not necessarily what I'm saying is I'm going to share my opinion, but I'm not going to turn this into a big political discussion about whether the rights or the wrongs of that. I'm just saying that that's been consistently reported in the press, that there's been more of a left-leaning bias at YouTube. But I think you're right. Like if we start seeing the balance forming in places like YouTube, if we start seeing the balance forming elsewhere, I think that would be good. But I just don't know how they're going to accomplish this. You know, I trust that Google will do the very best that they can to get the best outcome here. I don't buy that Google is this big kind of like left-leaning conspiracy against, you know, the right wing. I don't believe that for a second. But there's, you know, we'll see. The proof is in the pudding, right? So.
And I think the other thing that's interesting here is subscribe with Google is basically the reverse of, what was it, Google Contribute?
Yes, Google Contributor.
Contributor, which did not do well.
As far as I can tell, hardly anyone even heard of it. Nobody used it.
Well, one thing that I've talked about a little bit on the show previously is I think making it easier for people to make more transitory decisions about groups or organizations they support will be a good thing. So, for example, you mentioned earlier on, Ak, about this subscribe thing. Right now, yes, I could go and subscribe to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, whatever else, but I'd have to go in and probably there's going to be a commitment for a certain period of time. I've got to enter my credit card details, and it's a process to subscribe to something. If I could, for example, be able to press a button and subscribe to something, you know, for either an article or for a month or for a couple of weeks, and it's easy for me to jump between these different things and select which things I'm subscribing to. So it's almost like micro payments for these different publishers. I think that would be really cool. I'd love to see the same thing for example, we talked about this previously about...
to be what they're doing, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I don't know.
But it's very, very, very early stages, yeah. But they're not talking about one-off payments or even short subscriptions. They seem to be talking about a longer-term subscription. You're just paying via Google, which is not significantly
easier.
It's
not very exciting, is it?
No, and yeah. I don't see what's going to be different that's going to make people do this. And if it does take off, I don't see why Google deserve 5% of all the money that goes to newspapers. But, you know, maybe I'm missing something fundamentally cool about it.
If they're providing a service...
Yeah, but I don't get what the services that service. They're providing. I mean, I could go and subscribe to The Guardian today.
Yeah, but they're providing a payment platform. I mean, if in the same way that people will take... I agree, but just because they've already got just because The Guardian, you can already pay through their thing. If Google provide another option that The Guardian are happy to provide as well, that doesn't mean that it doesn't cost anything for Google to run that option.
This pops out, I don't get what the point of this. Why it's any more interesting than just sign into the New York Times and pay with your Google account, which
there's a lot of companies that are looking at the success of Netflix and the success of Spotify and subscription services of those ilk and saying we can do that in other verticals.
Right.
But it's what the New York Times already has such a subscription service,
No, but I think that the consensus seems to be, if you look at how the PR and all these things are worded, is millennials like subscriptions, and they don't want to pay the Times and the Post and some other thing. They just want to pay one fee every month
different. Bear with me. Is the assumption that you're basing this on that you join subscribe with Google and then you get access to the Washington Post and the FT and McClatchy? Ah, right. I didn't take that from what they were saying. If that's what it is, if it's a one-time only payment and gives you access to a bunch of different newspapers, great. That is a fundamentally different thing to what currently exists. My impression from it was that you'd be able to use subscribe with Google to join the Financial Times, and then you could read stuff in the FT, just like their existing subscription program, except now it's got the Google logo on top of it for no reason. That's why I didn't understand why it was interesting. If it's a bundled package, then great, absolutely. And that's genuinely valuable at that point.
All right. What's next?
Right. Next item of news. Should we talk about Cambridge Analytica?
Yeah. Now, some people won't know what's going on here. Give them an overview.
Right. We mentioned earlier that the Uber self-driving car thing is breaking news. The Cambridge Analytica story is the most breaking news thing imaginable. I mean, new things are coming out every hour as we record this. So, Cambridge Analytica are a data analytics firm who claim to be able to use data to guide decisions and to shape the social story and so on and so forth. They, among other things, they're involved with the Trump election. They're involved with the Brexit vote in the UK. A whistleblower from Cambridge Analytica has claimed that they harvested millions and millions and millions of Facebook profiles via rather dodgy means. So you had apps which got you to log in with Facebook, didn't have anything to do with, you know, politics or what they were collecting data from. Those apps not only collected your data, but the data of all of your friends as well, and then put it into a massive, great big database which Cambridge Analytica had. The Cambridge Analytica people vociferously deny that this was the case and also say, but everyone's doing it anyway. Right, they're on record as claiming they didn't use Facebook data at all to guide this kind of information when apparently they did. It's not clear whether they did anything wrong, if they did something wrong, whether it's them that did something wrong, or it's Facebook doing things wrong for allowing this in the first place. Whether Facebook do actually allow it, should Facebook be doing more to prevent it? Does this mean that you've got a company who are pushing people to voting for things they shouldn't do? Is this anything to do with the army of bots on Twitter, which retweet stuff, etc., etc.? This is a really, really, really big thing. Is that a good summary?
Yeah.
this is a hard subject to talk about because there's a lot of ramifications. There's an awful lot of, well, we're not sure what happened here stuff.
And it's, I have a question.
And it's not wholly clear whether, even if everything they're accused of is true, whether that's actually wrong anyway at the moment. I think a lot of people would like for it not to be the case, but that doesn't necessarily mean they did anything wrong. At the moment,
I have a couple of questions because I've been following this at a high level, but I've not dug into it in a great level of detail. So this Cambridge Analytica, when they've been harvesting this information, is this primarily? I mean, is this just public information, right? This is stuff that's on people's profiles.
Not really, because it's data which you can get if you're friends with someone. But
right.
But what was happening was people said there was a quiz app, among other things, and if you signed this quiz app, it would harvest, pull data from your profile, but also all of your friends as well. And there was quite a lot of data they could get access to. Now, Facebook have tightened up which data you can get from them, but it's not clear whether they did that because people were reconstructing the social graph or because they don't want people to do this or what.
Let me understand this more correctly. So if I'm Cambridge Analytica, I create this quiz app, right?
Yeah.
I put it on Facebook. Stuart Langridge, who doesn't really use Facebook.
I'm not a good example, but go on.
Let's pretend you do. All right. Stuart Langridge goes and does the quiz.
Yeah.
It pops up the thing saying, Facebook, Cambridge Analytica quiz app would like access to fucking everything. Allow or disallow. And you click allow, right? Because you don't read it.
Yeah.
It gets all of your information, but you're saying that then it would get information from me as well.
Yes, that's as I understand it. Yes.
On Earth, that doesn't sound viable to me. I would have thought that Facebook's inbuilt permission system would not allow
that. Well, there are a couple of things here. First of all, I think you are a naive child. Secondly, leaving that to one side. They didn't harvest all this data yesterday. They've been doing it over time, and Facebook have tightened this stuff up over time, right? So that may make some difference. Now, there is concern that Facebook did that because people were basically able to reconstruct the graph, the social graph, without actually connecting to Facebook to do it. Now, the whistleblower bloke, Christopher Wiley, his name is, he said, we had data on millions and millions of people. Mm-hmm. And we're able from that to predict the kind of things they read, the kind of things they looked at, where they go for news, all this kind of thing, right? But again, we don't know whether what he's saying is completely the truth or what, right? This is all, it's very fast-moving story.
Let us be clear on this. If going through the example that I just gave, if you go through the quiz and me as being a friend to you, it can suck out my permissions because we're friends.
Yeah.
If effectively Facebook's permission model is, if you are friends, then you can act as a conduit to somebody else's information that's on their profile. If that was the case, that is fucking ridiculous.
Yes, it is.
Like, that is outrageous. And I'm not a massive fan of Facebook, but I would be very surprised if that was in play, if it operated that way.
I
think you should be prepared to be fairly surprised.
Yeah, I think you may want to gear up for the idea
maybe, but I mean, I would have imagined that a modern software company like Facebook, even in the earlier days, would realize that that's a stupid idea.
We shall see about that. People are trying to find out.
Where's the evidence for this? So what's the evidence from this whistleblower?
Well,
dude?
you've got the whistleblower bloke who's claimed it. At the moment, the Information Commissioner's Office here in the UK have applied for a warrant to get into Cambridge Analytica's office in London, which they are in the process of getting. Right now, before the ICO could get in there and look at Cambridge Analytica's machines. Facebook engineers have gone to Cambridge Analytica. Maybe they're just there to like have a cup of tea and a chat. I don't know. It's hard to tell exactly what's going on at the moment. So we need to wait to see exactly how this shakes out. MPs have demanded that Zuckerberg show up and testify about all this stuff. Zuckerberg appears to have not said word one in public since this story broke. So
his PR department are doing their job well.
Depends on your point of view. I mean, if you've got nothing positive to say, then perhaps you shouldn't say anything. Equally, you're not supposed to, if you're the CEO of one of the biggest companies on earth, hide down a well until the problem goes away. Right?
Rule number one in crisis management. Don't say anything, particularly if you are a founder of a Silicon Valley company, where many founders of Silicon Valley companies are, in fact, gobshites.
We don't exactly know. There are some pieces to this which look remarkably sinister. There are some pieces to it which may mean that it's all been blown up out of nothing. And it's hard to tell exactly where the truth lies at the moment.
Can I make a prediction? Because, you know, all of our predictions are usually quite good. My prediction is this. I don't believe that Facebook had the ability for you to be able to suck out someone's information via their friend's profile.
Okay, I'll take the other side of that bet.
You all right? So you take that side. I'll take that side. I'm, and this may be naive boyhood at play. I think what's happened here is Cambridge Analytica will have been basically screen scraping as much information as they could get from everybody's. They've basically been sucking down public information, which there is still an open question around that, of course, whether that's okay and all the rest of it. And we've discussed this before on the show, but I think that's going to be I think Facebook will come out of this that there was no subterfuge at play. It was Cambridge Analytica basically sucking down public information
I am more than happy to take the other side of that bet.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm curious to see what's happened.
Do you fall on?
Yeah, where do you fall on it?
Strongly to the other side.
As in to Axe side?
Correct.
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what happens.
I think I've made my opinions on Facebook's business methodology is pretty clear in past shows. So
yeah, you have.
It should surprise absolutely nobody.
You have indeed. Next time I do my privacy talk, this might come up in a slide or two. I think this whole brouhaha. So
next bit of news. I have a little bit, which is from NVIDIA. So NVIDIA and Microsoft have decided to collaborate in something called RTX, which is real-time ray tracing in DirectX to produce cinematic quality real-time games. I think this is just kind of interesting because people have been working on like real-time ray tracing for many years, and it's always been, you know, running on super powerful computers in labs somewhere. So I think it's kind of interesting that this has now been exposed as actually a technology that people can utilize in DirectX. Like, they've got a bunch of like Unity and other games providers, game engine manufacturers are signed onto this. So I think it's been quite interesting to see the nature of video games potentially changing as hardware is becoming powerful enough to actually do real-time ray tracing. And I'm curious to see what that's going to look like, because games today look just phenomenal. I mean, yeah. I built this machine, and I think I said this when on a previous show, I gave Battlefield 1 a run, and I couldn't believe how good it looked.
This is my thought, right? We already have what I consider to be cinematic quality real-time games. Is there not a point of diminishing returns here, right?
It's going to be...
I look at it and go, wow, that's amazing. I don't know how much more amazing it could be.
Yeah, so yeah, it's the time is ready now for Tux Car Ray Tracing Edition.
There it is.
It's Frozen Bubble Ray Tracing Edition.
There it is. That's absolutely what it's going to be. It'd be interesting to see, because what's interesting is this is in DirectX, but it's not in Vulkan, for example.
Yes.
So I don't know exactly what that'll mean, but we shall find out.
Yeah. I'm assuming that's the Microsoft side of the collaboration. I suspect it'll come to Vulkan shortly after. So, but yeah, interesting. What else have we got? I have one more.
Go on then.
WebOS is open source.
I was going to say, when I saw this, I was surprised because I thought to myself, I really thought that already happened. And I looked back, and it wasn't that HB completely open sourced it. It was that they open sourced kind of, as you Brits would say, bits and bobs of it.
Yes.
But, yeah, but never the whole thing. I didn't realize.
Yeah, there was never a point at which you could go, I want a WebOS device, and just download it from GitHub, and then you were good.
Yeah.
There was some, but not others, and I mean, I thought it had largely gone away, but then I found out that they started putting in LG TVs years ago, and I knew that, but they're still doing it.
Yeah,
apparently, which I didn't realize. So fair play. It'd be nice to see a renaissance. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We bought moving into the new place. We bought two LG TVs running WebOS. It's actually pretty nice. It's a pretty nice platform. There's a limited amount of apps that run on it, but the usual ones like Netflix and whatever else. But they've done a pretty nice job of it. So I'm curious to see, you know, what's going to happen, because Tizen has not been a resounding success. I mean, it's running on a bunch of Samsung devices, but and I think Intel dropped it, didn't they? I think they dropped their participation.
I don't know if they've officially dropped it or whether every time someone says, "So how's your participation in Tizen?" they go, "Look, the Goodyear blimp," and then run out of the room.
So
I look forward to the next kickstarted trio, and we'll quite happily back said device.
The key thing here is, I think I can't see anyone producing a phone with this on, for reasons discussed ad nauseam on the show in the past, but because it's been repurposed for other devices, maybe we'll see people making set-top boxes or something like that using WebOS as the kind of low-level constraint, if they're not just going to put Chrome on it.
Right.
Will be interesting to see. Okay.
Will be. Perfect. All right.
Jeremy, did you have another one? I'm not sure whether I deleted any more of your thing.
I think that's... Well, I had Stephen Hawking in there, but...
Oh, yeah. That's sad. On the other hand,
I want to end on that sad note.
Sad that he's dead, but it was announced only about an hour before we started recording that he's going to be...
Oh, this is cool, yeah.
He's going to be buried in Westminster Abbey.
Yeah, and did you see that he submitted like a research paper 2 weeks before he passed away about parallel universes?
I did not. Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
I might read that. It'll be on Sci-Hub.
Parallel universes. I don't even know where to begin.
And on that bombshell.
Yeah, well, rest in peace, Mr. Hawking.
Yeah, thanks, pal. Yeah.
What a fucking tremendous human being. And sadly missed. So, but anyway, onwards and upwards.
So, Mycroft. Now, we've spoken before on the show about the Mycroft project. Some of us bought the Mycroft Mark 1. What this is it's an open source based home assistant. And they put out the Mark 1, it got kickstarted, it arrived. They've now kickstarted a Mark 2, which has been pretty successful on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I have opinions about Mycroft after having spent a great deal of my hard-earned money on Mark 1. So it will be interesting to see what people think about the Mark 2 and what you chaps think about it, whether you're going to buy it, what you think about it, so on and so forth.
So maybe we should provide a little bit of background, a little bit of history on this. So for the Mark 1, and I also want to provide, in the interest of full disclosure, a bit of a caveat here. So I've done some consulting with Mycroft around the Mark 2 and did a little bit around the Mark 1 as well. So just wanted to get that out there. But the Mark 1, one of the reasons before I did any consulting with them, what attracted me to it was that completely open source, completely open hardware. And they kicked off this campaign. It kind of came out of nowhere. And many of us did a bunch of promotion around it, like to support it. They got funded and they shipped it. It shipped a lot later, than I think we would have liked. And that was some of the feedback that I gave them when I consulted with them around the first time was, you know, get more information out about it. Cause look, late shipping with Kickstarter campaigns is not unusual. And it's invariably because organizations, particularly hardware organizations, don't necessarily realize the delays that are involved in shipping hardware and the process of shipping hardware. So I think they probably fell into a trap that other companies have fallen into as well. But they did ship it. They got it out there. And it's, in my mind, it's decent. You know, like, I've got one. I don't use it particularly often. But I think they did a decent job starting out with this, and I think they were putting a lot of the foundational stuff in. Language, you bought one as well. What was your take on the
I did.
The Mark now, 1 before we get to the Mark 2?
So, the Mark 1, I, like you, was fascinated by the idea that this was something which had started before we really saw Google Home, Amazon's Echo, so on and so forth. Before they'd even really kicked off, we had a chance to actually steal a march on the competition here. We then waited an awfully long time for it to come out. When it came out, there were extra charges based on shipping. There were extra charges again based on customs things because I was in the UK, so on and so forth. So it ended up costing quite a bit. And when it arrived, there were various ups and downs and things with how one set it up and so on and so forth. And what started off looking like quite a cool device when they originally spec'd it didn't look quite as cool by the time it arrived and people had an Amazon Echo, which was smaller and slimmer and with a better quality speaker and for considerably less money and so on and so forth. But I could have let all that go to one side, right? Because we had a thing which was competitive, and it was all based on open source, and it was done by a company who were doing the right thing, and so on and so forth. The big downside with the Mark 1, from my point of view, is that it's shit.
It's a nuanced point from Mr. Lowe.
I consider myself reasonably up to speed with the Home Assistant world, right? And Mycroft's speech recognition and the way it approaches things and the way it's controlled and everything, and all of that is bobbins. All of it. I've tried using it really hard and you can't get it to understand anything. There is a legendary video done by friend of the show, Alan Pope.
Is this the beans video?
It's the beans video. We have to link it in the show notes where he says, "Mycroft, what are beans?" Right? And it obviously picked the first result from a Google search or something, and then it starts reading out the recipe, the ingredients list from a tin of beans. And it goes on and on and on. You can't stop it, right? You know, you go, Alexa, shut up, or whatever, right? Mycroft doesn't seem to pay attention to that. And he's sitting there going, shut up, be quiet. And this thing's going, you know, 450 grams of beans, calories 360, just on and on and on. And I ran the Mycroft software on my local machine before there ever was a Mycroft hardware platform to put it on, right? Mm-hmm. With the intention of getting involved in this. It's rubbish. It recognizes nothing. I can't even get it to do simple things like Mycroft, what time is it? The recognition rate's about 40% on things like that, let alone arbitrary skills and so on. Right. The expectation shortfall was tremendous on the Mark 1. And so I was completely, completely, completely skeptical about the idea that a new thing should come out rather than replacing the old one. And I assumed that my Mark 1 would now be consigned to the dustbin of history. However, in their defense, after I assumed that, I went and asked, and they've explicitly said, we totally plan on keeping Mycroft compatible with the Mark 1. The Mycroft core package upgrades just like normal, and there's a Mycroft Mark 1 package, which is just hardware parts related to the Mark 1 itself. And they say they're running the same software. The wait word recognizer and text-to-speech and so on is the same across the Mark 1 and the Mark 2. So we're expecting that if there are material improvements in the Mark 2, that the Mark 1 will also get loads better, at which point I will be more than happy to use it.
To be fair to the Mycroft folks, when they ran the Mark 1 campaign as well, they very clearly stated that this was kind of like an early device, and they said that, you know...
When I unboxed mine, there's a little card in it saying, hey, guess what? This is for developers. Don't expect it to be good. And,
right.
And they weren't wrong. I mean, I think the card should have been about 200 feet tall. But apart from that...
I think I have multiple problems here. As a point of feedback for the company, if anyone is listening there, I don't think there's anyone on the planet than me, and collectively as a group of us, that would absolutely unequivocally love a completely open software, a completely open hardware, privacy-focused digital assistant that's loaded with features and is increasingly intelligent. There's an open software stack behind it. I desperately would like for this to exist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. It's brilliant. The concept is fantastic. That's what I meant about the expectations.
Issue is their messaging and their expectations. I think when they failed so spectacularly at the first Kickstarter, going back to Kickstarter, to me, I just don't like that. It doesn't feel right to me, right?
I understand what you're saying.
How people are using Kickstarter now. People are acting like, it's not. You're not buying something. It's an investment. It's not an investment because you don't get part of the company. What you're doing is you're playing a smaller than normal amount of money as a bet that this thing will exist in the future and you'll get it as a discount. That's not.
I've not seen anyone say that.
Everyone says you're investing in the future. You're not. You're buying the future, certainly.
Well, hang on a second. There's a difference there.
So we can all communicate with each other. And the fact that people use the word investing, I also don't like that.
I agree, but when you just said that, you made it sound like Kickstarter campaigns are saying that you're investing in the company.
And many of them are very much worded in that manner.
Right, and if they're doing that, then that's wrong. I agree. I'm just saying I haven't seen that. I've seen people saying investing in the future. People use that term all the time, right? You know, and I think what they're basically saying is you're going to back this campaign to give us the money that we will then build something that will make the future better. So, yeah, words have meaning, but I would say that I think you're reading too much into those words.
Okay, I guess I just don't like that Kickstarter has become a weird thing where companies on their fifth product are still using Kickstarter. And at that point, either you're a sustainable company, in my opinion, take funding and do things the right way, or you're not. But it just seems like an odd way to leverage people's goodwill and expectations in a long-term way.
I understand what you're saying. Unfortunately, I don't think the universe agrees because they wanted $36,000.
I don't think they set good expectations. The other thing is, Google has basically all the resources on the planet. They sell a device at $99. Amazon has basically all of the resources on the planet. They sell a device at $85. I cannot conceive that Mycroft will ever be in a position to offer something that's even in the remote order of magnitude is good. It seems impossible for me at the rate that especially Amazon is innovating in this space. It doesn't seem like a viable competition. I don't know where they get as desperately as I would like them to win, not even compete, but win. It just seems like the Amazon will, you know, I've said this in a couple of shows, but Amazon will spend more on paper plates for office parties than Mycroft has access to as an entire organization, and they're years and years ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can break this into two pieces, right? There is what have Mycroft done already, and is it good? And are they heading in the right direction?
So I missed the funding window. We talked about it on the show. I had meant to fund it, and then I missed it by a day or something. So I did not ever have access to a Mark One.
But I know you wanted to.
I really did. Yeah.
And the first question is right here,
in my hand. It lives on my desk.
so the first question is, what have they done? Are they heading in the right direction? The second question to me is, what is the likelihood of them succeeding in the broader market? I would agree with you, Jeremy. Much as I fully support their efforts, I think they've got a steep hill to climb because they've got some formidable competition. But history has taught us that, you know, sometimes these snappy little companies come out of nowhere and do good stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
But there's no doubt that it's a steep
And they have an awesome differentiator in that they can build an open source community that will write a whole bunch of integrations that Amazon maybe never will. So they definitely have a, I think, really strategic differentiator in making everything open source. So,
I think the you know, the 1,000 true fans thing, that kind of applies here. They can be, for Google and Amazon, if this thing, we would like to see Home Assistant and mostly Alexa, to be honest with you, in 40% of homes in over the course of the next year. But if a project is not operating at that kind of level, Amazon and Google will drop it. Whereas Microsoft can be sustainable and good and a bit more niche with a much smaller group of users. And therefore, even if they only end up selling to the sorts of people who are slightly disquieted by Google and Amazon's collection of data, that's okay, because there will be enough of those to keep a company like Microsoft sustainable and therefore provide something to that market segment, which is in itself good. Right? Because all three of us are a little bit in that direction, and we'd be happy to support this kind of thing if it wasn't bollocks. But it's
so the thing is, it's got to be technically
competitive. I don't even mind if it's not price competitive. If you look at it now, right, as Jeremy says, the Echo is the full on Echo is $99, the Dot is smaller, and the Microsoft Mark II is on sale for $180. Now that's, sorry, the Mark I is on sale for $180. That's twice as much money, but they are going to have larger overheads. They are a smaller company. And I'm okay with that.
To be clear, personally, would absolutely pay more for this.
Yeah, yeah. If it could be, I mean, if it could be technically competitive.
Right. To be fair, in the Kickstarter campaign, the Mark II is $139. So it's not massively. It's more expensive, of course it is, but it's not crazy out of whack.
Remember that's a Kickstarter price, though.
But also remember that the Mark II, that's the Mark II with a screen.
No, right? The Mark II with the screen is $179.
And what's the expected shipping date?
Hang on.
Unless
Wrong, Ak. The Mark II with the 189 is the Mark II, which includes the camera. Okay?
Oh, the camera. Sorry, what did you say?
Screen.
The Mark II, the base Mark II has got a screen. It's $139.
Right, yes.
So I would say it's more comparable to like the Show.
It's more comparable to the Echo Show, yes.
How much is the Echo Show in dollars?
You'd have to check in dollars. The Mark I is currently on sale for $180, which is directly competitive to the Echo, which is $99. So the Mark I is currently approximately twice the price of its Amazon
competitor.
The Echo Show is $229.
Right. In that case, the Mark II depends on how much it goes up when it stops being a Kickstarter.
Although, isn't it actually closer to the Echo Spot, which is $129, which does have a screen, but is smaller.
Yeah, which is tiny.
So price-wise, it's not completely out of the realm of reasonability.
No.
And,
not at all.
And I think we're all fine with the price. So, Jeremy says, don't mind paying a little bit more for this because you're getting something more tuned to your particular requirements.
Right. So, I think we'd all agree that they've got a steep mountain to climb. So the big question is question number one, which is, are they doing a good job within the parameters of what they've been doing? Now, I haven't used the Mark I for a while, I'll be honest with you. And I've never used the Mark II, and I haven't installed updates on my Mark I. Ak, have you installed the most recent update on the Mark I?
That's going to be the question. I do not have the most recent update, and I want to get that and test it and see if it's improved as much as they claim. Because that's the key thing. I mean, I think we'd all agree that they're unlikely to be as businessly competitive as we might ideally like them to be, just because they don't have the reach that Amazon and Google do. But can they be technically competitive is another question. Based on what the Mark I was like before, the answer is an emphatic no. However, the new software, 18.02b, was meant to be out in February. So the key point here is to try that and then to try it again when the Mark II comes out and see if it is actually more competitive than it was. I don't even mind if there's an error rate, right? My Echo has an error rate. It's just that there were more errors than not.
Yeah. Well, there's a baseline where it goes from being an experiment to being something you can use on a daily basis.
Yes, and it was nowhere near that line, and the Echo is way over it.
Right, and and from what I understand, again, this is from some of the conversations that I've had with the company, and I, again, I haven't used the Mark II and I haven't used the Mark I for a while. But from what I understand, like the evolution of the software has been growing quite significantly. Now, again, I defer to people to actually try it and check it out. But I would argue that if you're plotting a graph in terms of does it work, and that graph is going up at a reasonable rate of knots, then I think that's a good sign.
They do 6 monthly releases. So you've got 1802, and so it's on the Ubuntu model, they do 1802, then there's 1808 due out later in the year.
Right.
So it will it'd be interesting to see. They're switching to DeepSpeech as their speech to text engine, which will hopefully improve.
And the thing I would say is, kind of going back to Jeremy's comment earlier on about Kickstarter, I agree that I think there are some somewhat unscrupulous campaigns that kick off, but in this case, I wouldn't leverage that towards the Mycroft team, because I think they're genuinely creating a new device. Like, so this is a new product, which I think they are a small company, so right. I think they're still very much in that R&D phase. But the other thing as well is, I was impressed, I'm not going to compromise any confidences with my consulting with them, but one piece of feedback which they were very receptive to that I gave to them was, you've got to be realistic about the reaction to the Mark I campaign, and you've got to be honest about that in the Mark II campaign. Like, don't hide things that went wrong in the first campaign. Be upfront about them and provide assurances around them in the Mark II campaign. And they were very receptive to that.
And to be so, very for example, clear, I don't think there was anything in any way, shape, or form unscrupulous going on in this particular case. My broader point about Kickstarter didn't even really apply to them. It's something that kind of grinds my gears a little bit. I just thought it was interesting that after having such a bad first experience, they chose their second experience to be the same experience.
Well, and that's where I disagree. I don't think they use Kickstarter, but I think that the way they went about it for the second one, clearly there was learnings in there. I mean, they were very upfront about. They were very upfront about, their experiences of working on hardware, and they've deferred some of the hardware stuff to other organizations and this, that, and the other. I actually did an interview with their CEO, Josh, and put it up on my YouTube channel. And I asked him pretty directly about this, and they we kind of got some things wrong. Now, the real proof in the pudding here is going to be shipping the Mark II.
Right.
And again, I gave this feedback. I was like, you can't get this wrong.
Right. fascinates me over and over again is software engineers completely underestimating how difficult hardware is.
Yeah.
Yes.
See, to me, I think the real test will actually be, slightly self-servingly, whether they update the Mark I and it becomes good.
Because
if they go, okay, we've shipped the Mark II, the Mark II is brilliant. The Mark I, though, it's running the same software, but actually it's problematic and we can't make it happen. Then they've taken a loyal customer base, a loyal community, and kicked them all in the teeth and made them buy all new stuff again, which is really annoying.
And this goes back to the thing that I shared on, was it the last show, maybe the previous one, about the Axe Effects? Like, one of the reasons why they've developed such a rabidly positive community is because they ship hardware and they repeatedly upgrade it with firmware updates.
Yeah, exactly.
And that builds real faith in people. I bet you anything, if Mycroft continuously ship a bunch of updates to the Mark I users.
Yeah. If the Mark II lives up to its promise and my Mark I becomes the same promising thing, then I will be perfectly happy.
Yeah, I actually think what it would do is it would convert people who are a little bit kind of either miffed or ambivalent about this to people who are like, wow, holy shit, that's really cool what they did.
It absolutely would do that for me, yes. So the thing to do then, me and you, Jono, is to install the latest version of the software and try it out. There are instructions on their website for how to do this.
Yes.
And you can actually do it by just saying, Mycroft install platform patch, and then it should update.
Nice.
Which is actually quite cool if it's true. I'm sure it's going to be install platform patch. install. But we shall see. So give it a try.
The one thing from a product perspective, again, not use the Mark II, but one thing I was pleased to see, and I gave this feedback to Mycroft both publicly and privately, was I didn't like the look of the Mark I. I thought it looked stupid.
I thought it looked more cool before everyone else came out with nicer alternatives. Remember, we saw the Mark I before we ever saw an Echo, before we ever saw a Google Home.
Yeah.
And once they come out, you're like, okay, what they need to look like is basically a salt cellar. And what this thing looks like is some kind of ancient 1980s bulky technology.
See, that's why I thought it was a little retro, which maybe I like. But, I mean, the Echo really just looks like a UE Boom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
we all would desperately like Mycroft to succeed in this regard. Yes. I think that's very clear. Do you guys think, wrapping this, kind of bringing this train into the station, as Mr. Bacon would say, what do you think the realistic odds of meaningful success are? And you can define success and whatever terms you'd like.
Langridge, you're the expert on assistance. You go first.
All I have to go on from a software perspective is the Mark I so far, and that was terrible. But hopefully the 1802 release will be... If that's significantly better, I'm more than happy to revise this. But so far, I'm not confident from a technological point of view. From a market success point of view, I do not think it will be the next Amazon Echo, but I do not think it has to be. I think if they could get 20,000 people to buy this...
That will enjoy.
I absolutely think it's a sustainable business.
Okay. That's success then to me.
If they get it right. And that to me is success.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Okay. Cool.
I would say, I think that this is going to be somewhat unsurprising that there's a community reference here. I think there's a huge opportunity for Mycroft. And I think there is the baseline of, like, you have to be able to talk to it and it will work. And yes, they have to get that right. If that doesn't work, then it's going to fail. Like, if it doesn't operate at a basic level as an assistant, then people will not use it. They will consider it broken. It will become the Chumby of the future.
Oh, nice reference, sir.
Oh yeah, yeah. The open source sex pillow, as we nicknamed it.
Canonical. Yeah. Canonical.
Could have done without that reference, but.
But to me, where there's a real opportunity here for Mycroft is because it's open source, not so much the open source development of the platform itself. I think you'll have a limited number of people who might participate in that. But to me, is building a real platform where people can create skills that go to insane levels of customizability. Like, I think right now, I have Google Homes and they're decent and they... There's a bunch of stuff that it can do, and I use it, and it's rigged up in my house. But there feels like there's a gap between the Google Home and all of the more specific stuff I'd love to be able to do. And I can imagine, like, to me, one of the major benefits of open source is that long tail of people building stuff that scratches their itch and then is exposed in a Mycroft app store type place where you can get access to it. To me, that's the thing where they should focus. They should focus on building out a community of people who build skills. Like, to me, and I've said this before, the one person who epitomizes who should be the passionate Mycroft end user is Langridge. Yeah. Like, you are somebody who you're very interested in the UX of digital assistants and all the rest of it. You should be like the torch holder for Mycroft, and I think if they can attract you and if they can excite you about it, then they will excite other people about it.
They should try. Email address is on the website.
Yeah, I think there is so much potential here, so much potential, and because they're a small company, yes, they've got a big amount in decline, but I think they can be a lot more nimble as well. So
let's,
Jeremy,
hope it happens.
What do you think?
I mean, like I said, I'm curious to see how they iterate from here, given the resources that they have access to. But obviously, hope that they are able to build a community and leverage that community to succeed.
There we have it. We have another show in the can.
In the can, yes.
I just want to make a comment, by the way, before we go on. Sometimes we get people who reach out to us with various opportunities for, you know, for example, buying the forum or sponsoring the show.
I can't believe it. We have only had one person offer to buy the forum, to be clear. And you will be pleased to hear that forum posters in our community, that we immediately sold up. No, we didn't. The forum is still ours.
This is going to be a bit of a test to those of you who may be interested in purchasing the forum or sponsoring the show. There is a Space Raiders requirement that if you are going to make one of these offers, if you do not have at least three boxes of Space Raiders on the table, then we're not interested, okay? So just wanted to make sure that was clear.
There will be a large number of people, basically anyone who's not our age and from the UK, who'll be thinking, what are Space Raiders? And I believe you should have the joy of going and looking them up on Google yourself.
We'll make it easier for you. Type in Space Raiders snack. Okay, and you'll find it. Pickled onion is the only way forward.
Yeah. So very briefly before we all go, either of you speaking anywhere in the next couple of weeks?
No.
Nope. Cool. That's good.
I'm going to a conference next week, but I'm not speaking there. So, or this week, rather. So.
Okay. Always nice to fill people in.
Are you?
Yes. What?
Are you language?
No.
Speaking anywhere? No.
Well, technically I am tomorrow, but that'll be before the show comes out, so no.
So not useful. Tell people, come to my talk, which was yesterday.
Come to my talk, which was yesterday. Yeah, don't worry about it.
I bet it was brilliant, though, wasn't it?
It's got a nice ring to it. I will now, post-talk, say that I assume it was awesome.
Yeah, I can't believe you got that tattoo.
Congratulations and job well done.
Yeah, well done.
Shut up, both of you. Go away now.
Good idea. Bye.